The partisan divide has reached unhealthy levels for American democracy, and we can expect to see this division manifest in all of our least favorite ways with the election just around the corner. For some families, the only thing they might be thankful for this Thanksgiving is that COVID will keep them from gathering around the table with their uncle who rants every year about the direction of the country. Well, we don't have to give in to the vitriol. We can still value civility and compromise. We can choose to see the other political party as being made up of our neighbors and not a threat to the soul of the nation. In 2020, partisan divisions overflow into all of our institutions, even those thought to be fundamentally apolitical. Sanford Health's Dr. Wendell Hoffman joined us to talk about what he's seeing in the healthcare industry and why it matters.
So, yeah, we've got two simultaneous events going on, one which demands that we come together, the other one which is pulling us apart. In a normal political season, we'd be having, you know, aggressive debates. And it's not that we're not permitted to have our own biases or our own support. It's just that this time around, and I frankly have never seen it like this in 40-plus years in medicine, where it was where we're so quick to blame, which is very troublesome to me. In medicine, you know, if an adverse event happens, one of the things we've learned over time, and this is part of the patient safety movement, is that when something bad happens that you don't want to happen, the first impulse is not to blame but to learn. But what we're seeing in the current foray back and forth is the rush to blame. And so on the one hand, you have our president calling this the China virus. On the other hand, you have our Speaker of the House calling it the Trump virus. I don't think neither are helpful at all. Yes, the virus did come from China, by all evidence, from the Wuhan province. But we have not necessarily identified origins for all prior either epidemics or pandemics. I mean, the last pandemic, which was an influenza pandemic, started in Mexico. Well, we don't call it the Mexican pandemic, but we do cite areas of origin, like, let's say, West Nile. You know, that tells us about a geographic origin. How about Ebola? That cites a geographic origin. But in both those cases, in those two cases, the reason to use the term is not to blame, it's to learn. So that, in my opinion, is one of the big challenges that we have as a nation. How can we, from the middle, say, wait, from both ends, stop the destructive bias? Because it's preventing us from coming together. We need more than ever to focus on these team aspects that really will help mitigate the spread of this virus and help our fellow citizens and everyone across the board.
We, as in the non-medical public, want the medical journals and physicians like you to be completely nonpartisan and maybe even rely on that nonpartisanship. But you've been seeing evidence even in medical journals or with some leadership from some of these organizations that is revealing a bias as well. Tell me a little bit about that.
So I say that these examples of destructive bias, which, and again, it's destructive bias is anything which prevents us from coming together, as I'm defining it. These have been long-term weapons used, right? But when very outstanding premier journals show some evidence of political preference, and I cite two examples, Lancet and Nature, as examples. So the first one, Lancet's decision to publish a major study that diminished the role of hydroxychloroquine and also contributed to international changes in recommendation had to be pulled very quickly because the source of their data was highly questionable. So they had to pull it. And so the question was, and this was raised by a writer in the Wall Street Journal that said that Lancet's decision to publish a study with little apparent scrutiny suggests that politics may be influencing its scientific judgment. And I just said they're removing all doubt. Lancet had just earlier stated in its editorial page that Americans must put a president in the White House in January 2021 who will understand that public health not be guided by partisan politics. And I just simply almost cynically said how nonpartisan of Lancet not to be guided by partisan politics. And so that concerns me. Now, do I think that it's widespread that journals are politicizing, they're allowing their editorial page to politicize their research page? Absolutely not. But even one episode, I mean, it wasn't that Lancet or Nature, which was the second episode, who actually said just prior to the 2016 that, quote, Clinton must take the reins, end quote. And then a year later, they weighed in again, and they said after 12 months, quote, after 12 months in office, Trump's impact on science can be neatly divided into two categories, bad things that people expected and bad things that they didn't. And then I just, again, a little cynically say, sarcastically say, how scientific of Nature to be so neatly categorical. And so I put forward the question to both editorial boards, by what authority do you speak so confidently to the political realm when, per the literature of metascience, so much of what we publish is not entirely true? And so I'm just trying to, and again, I think both of these journals are outstanding. They're premier, which is why it was kind of disappointing. And I just point out that any organization who serves a diverse population of readers must be very careful. And it's fine if scientific journals have an issue-oriented criticism or praise. I think that's all fair game. But in this case, they rendered an opinion as to who should not be the American president. So, and I don't think this should happen ever. And yeah. And I say, imagine if a healthcare system were to weigh in on who should or should not be the American president. I mean, heads would roll. Even on one occasion, if we, and of course people say, well, we're a 501c3. I agree, but isn't there even a higher reason than your tax status not to be doing this? And so I just think, and I point these examples out, that it concerns me that the politics, that the politicization, like I said, the coronification of medicine has now become a subset of the politicization of everything. And so I don't ever want to see us, and again, I somewhat sarcastically say that perhaps the future of science will necessitate progressive and conservative journals, seriously. Perhaps we need to declare political conflicts of interest. That's kind of the idea that if we're going to start going down this road, there's going to be a lot to pay over time, and we just simply from the middle again have to say to both sides, whatever you're saying that becomes destructive to the coming together in a very crucial time where people's lives are on the line, stop it.
Political dialogue can sound more like sports fans arguing rather than citizens trying to discover the best answer to a problem. South Dakota Congressman Dusty Johnson has long been frustrated with the division we see today. During one of our recent interviews on In the Moment, he explained how what he calls the show horses in politics feed into the disunity.
You know, in Congress, you've got workhorses and you've got show horses, and then the show horses are the ones who spend half their day on one cable news station or another kind of yelling at the other side, and those people get famous, and I'm sure they end up being great fundraisers, and I'm sure they get a ton of people at their rallies, but, you know, it's hard to really identify how those people are getting anything specific done. So those are the show horses. The workhorses are the people who keep their head down, and they realize that ultimately we are constitutionally charged with running a country. And at least in the era of divided government, that's got to mean working with people that maybe you don't agree with all the time. So listen, I'm among the very most conservative members of the group, but I realize that the American people put Nancy Pelosi in charge of the House. I don't have to like that, and in fact, I don't. But if we're going to get anything good done for this country, it's going to be with a Democratic House and a Republican Senate, at least for a little while longer.
How much more can the country take? Civil unrest continues as Americans protest police brutality and systemic racism. We live amid the worst pandemic in living memory, and we suffer the economic and social consequences. And don't forget, we're still engaged in wars across the globe, while climate change threatens life itself. So, what are we to do? Well, we can do so much more than endure. Alexander Heffner is the host of The Open Mind on PBS. He's covered American politics and civic life since the 2008 presidential campaign. He brought us this take on the changing nature of politics in America.
I think that there's explaining to do. I don't know how much of it will be effective at this point, but I've been doing it for the last 6 years and explaining kind of the barriers to literacy and sort of an empathetic understanding of issues requiring nuance and rigor and depth in our learning and not being afraid of that pursuit. And, I've talked on many college campuses about sort of the rise of incivility or our crisis of incivility. And I don't view it as sort of just a question of decorum or manners. I often talk about the scourge of incivility as a threat to civil society. So when we think of the threats to civil society, I think of as bigotry in particular and sort of a closed-mindedness based on geography, based on race, based on religion. And those are divisive culture wars that have been incited in the last 3 years. Some would say very much unnecessarily, but as a political machination, in pursuit of a kind of new Southern strategy to win the 2016 election. But you know, the I think that message has resonated with a lot of audiences about sort of the bigotry of the incivility of bigotry, also the incivility of obstruction. You can't have a functioning state when you know you're kind of constantly in this budget impasse or policy impasse. You can't get legislation through any kind of deliberative democracy, and you can't even engage in the deliberative democracy because of the prejudice or the bigotry. I think that bigotry and obstruction and obstructionism are threats that have resonated as I've talked about them on the show and sort of presented why the show's function is important, not just in the information ecosystem that has bled nearly to death because of Facebook and Twitter and folks who are not responsible for truth on their platforms and abdicate that moral responsibility totally. In a climate that is what we have today, there has been for the last several years a hunger for purposeful media that is educational in nature and designed to kind of counteract all the influence of the disinformation on platforms, not just the social media, but also some of the partisan propaganda too. So yeah, I think that there's been a messaging and interviews, discourse that have been employed that have resonated, and especially when thinking about kind of how we can push back against the bigotry and obstructionism in the discourse.
Let's look at things at home. If it seems to you that the South Dakota State Legislature, with its supermajority of Republicans, does not reflect the entire public, well, it does reflect the people who are actually voting. In the United States and South Dakota, the level of civic engagement can be embarrassingly low, especially among younger voters and those with lower incomes. According to the South Dakota Secretary of State's office, statewide voter turnout in the June 2020 primary was 27.98%, with only 153,031 ballots cast. That means 72.2% of registered voters did not go to the polls. So that unhinged uncle of yours, well, he might be politically engaged or consider himself well-informed, but you're not really sure if he votes or if he even knows what district he lives in. South Dakota Secretary of State Steve Barnett joined us to talk about the upcoming election here at home.
The deadline to register to vote or to even update an address, so to speak, would be October 19th, 5 p.m. local time. So if individuals need to do that, they can download a voter registration form on our website, which is just www.sdsos.gov, or they can have their county auditor send them one too. Either way would work, or they can go down to the county auditor's office and register there as well.
Tell us a little bit about what we learned during the primary season about absentee ballots, because that was during a time of increased numbers, as many people were concerned about going to the polls safely with a virus that we understood very little about. What did we learn then that is going to help us in November? What's changed between then and now?
Yes. Well, I would say at least we decided with the information that we had at the time, and not a lot of people, as you said, there was still a lot of uncertainty in April about this virus. Our office decided to go ahead and send out an absentee ballot application form to every registered voter in South Dakota. So what that did is it allowed, we thought that would help kind of relieve some pressure off the polling sites. And if in the event people didn't have access to the internet or a printer, they could just send that form in and accompany it with a photo ID, or else they could get it notarized and their ballot could be sent to them. So, and we felt it was a good decision, and the turnout of the ballots cast in this past primary in June, Lori, was for absentee ballots themselves was 58.36. So over half the voters that cast a ballot in that primary voted absentee. So it was a very popular decision. And then the turnout itself was good as well. Like we had right around 28% for the primary, which that was the highest turnout in a primary since 2008. So even though it was a different, we kind of were going through some different times, people found a way to exercise the right to vote.
So all those people who requested those absentee ballots back then, are they still receiving absentee ballots for the general election? Was that automatic?
Yes. A popular question right now is in box four of that form, it asks what election voters would like to receive an absentee ballot for. So if somebody requested, if they check the all box or the general box, they will get, they are already in the queue, so to speak, and their ballot will be sent out tomorrow. If they cannot recall which box they checked, they can call their county auditor to see if they already signed up for an absentee ballot, or they can go to our website, sdsos.gov, and click under on the voter information portal, and they'll be able to see if they are in the queue to receive an absentee ballot here.
All right. What are tips to making sure that your vote counts? If you're voting absentee, that ballot arrives in the mail and you want to make sure it gets where it needs to go. You want to avoid those errors that could get it disqualified and make sure it gets there on time. Walk us through some of those steps, please.
Yes. Another great question, Lori. Voters really need to be prudent that they're filling out, that they're signing the back of the manila envelope that where their ballot is enclosed. Auditors are very good, especially if they receive that ballot with ample time. If they receive it like beginning October, they can call that voter and say, hey, you forgot to sign the back, but can you come on down and sign it so this ballot will count. And again, just if they're filling out the application form itself, it just needs to be accompanied by a photo ID or notarized, and it requires a wet signature and a date as well. So just to make sure that they slow down and complete the entire form, and then when the ballot comes, to fill out the ballot and then sign the back of that manila envelope. And then voters can mail that back, and I would encourage them to do that on the front end. There's been a lot of stories about the Postal Service and stuff, and our office can't speak to the staffing levels of the of the Postal Service, but we're confident that they can handle the load here coming up. But we just encourage them to send them in more on the front end, so that allows them some time to get back. And a lot of county auditors too, Lori, have drop boxes located maybe adjacent to the courthouse or the county auditor's office, so voters can drop those off there as well.
In 2016, we were talking a lot about perhaps, outside meddling with votes and with elections, and talking to the Secretary of State then about our paper ballots. This year, we have, the same kind of dialogue going on, only increasingly because of paper ballots or mail-in ballots on a national level. We've heard different things from the president. So from a South Dakota perspective, speak to meddling with elections. Is the process riddled with fraud, and I use that in quotation marks?
Well, one thing that we have in South Dakota, as you mentioned, are paper ballots. So nothing, our tabulating machines, there's nothing that's connected to the internet. So some people would argue that's a little archaic and old-fashioned, but it's very safe and secure. So in regards to meddling with the internet and stuff like that from adversaries, I'm not concerned about that. We've had meetings with folks at the federal level, with Department of Homeland Security, and, of course, our state agency, BIT, which stands for the Bureau of Information and Telecommunications. We've been in contact with their chief information officer, and they monitor how many, if people are trying to ping our database and that kind of thing. But nothing is connected to the internet on the election. So we're confident about that. Where people need to be aware of, Lori, is misinformation and disinformation on social media. If they see like over 53% of the posts on social media are false, that's over half. So if people see something, like something says the Republicans vote on Tuesday, Democrats vote on Wednesday, or if they see something that says vote via text, those are false statements, and they should really check their sources. Our official Twitter handle is at SODAK, SODAKSOS, and that's our official Facebook page as well. So if they have any questions on that, they should call their county auditor or our office to verify the information they're seeing online.
Does a delay in getting election results indicate that something has gone wrong, or is it part of the natural process? Talk a little bit about the time and what our expectations should be on November 3rd and November 4th with results.
Well, as we learned in the primary, one thing that, just to give you an idea, like the 2016 primary election, there were, of the votes, of the total votes cast, 13.92% of those, so just under 14%, were cast via absentee. So this last primary in June here in 2020, we had over 58% that were absentee. So I'm not taking anything away from the poll workers on election day, but really a lot of the bulk of the work gets shifted from the election day workers over to the county auditor's office. So now, because they are more labor intensive in that they are verifying signatures on the application form to the signature, to the wet signature on the back of the manila envelope where the ballot is enclosed. So what auditors have done has they're trying to beef up their staff a little bit. I think a lot of them are working with their county commissioners to see, perhaps train other county employees to help them get those ballots sorted into the different precincts. And then they can't open those ballots until Election Day. So there are steps they can take prior to Election Day, but the biggest thing right now is that they're trying to train more employees, more horsepower, so to speak, so they can, start opening those ballots right away and get them organized and then get those results out in a timely manner.
Once again, you must register to vote by October 19th. Unsure how? Check out sdpb.org/election, where you can find our 2020 election guide, hear interviews with candidates hoping to represent you in peer. There are video summaries of the ballot measures and links with explanations on how to register and vote in person or by mail. Perhaps we can't talk about this election without talking about women in politics. This year is the 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, and more women are running in the United States than ever before. Amy Scott Stoltz is president of the League of Women Voters in South Dakota. That's a nonpartisan political organization with roots in women's suffrage. Amy joins us to talk election 2020.
A democracy without voters is not a democracy. And the more that people vote, the more people vote, the more that our elected officials will represent our communities as a whole. The importance of voting is really lies with the democratic process. Without our voters, there is no democratic process. So everyone's voice is important, and being knowledgeable about the vote is important. And that's why our vote411.org website is one of the things that we do to educate voters. There's also going to be virtual and in-person candidate forums where you can hear from your candidates. A lot of people are struggling with door-to-door processes this year because of the pandemic. So you may not get somebody knocking on your door like you may have in the past. And so finding out information has become more of an electronic piece. And why is it important for the electronic piece? Well, we're in the middle of a pandemic. Not everyone is able to get out. So, you know, the candidates are realizing this and being more proactive in getting their information out. And these are your neighbors and your coworkers who are running for office. So getting to know them is important, and getting to follow them as they are elected and making decisions, that gives you a voice to go in and let them know what's going on in your world, so that they're making decisions based on more voices in our community.
Mike Wagner has traveled the world with organizations, teams, and executives dealing with the challenges of leadership and culture. He's a former South Dakota state lawmaker, and he's founder of the blog uncommonwisdom.org. Mike joined us to bring his perspective on the environment of this year's election.
There's very clearly a situation of society-wide, you know, bias and privilege and what have you that's getting a lot of press these days. And so there's a lot of our institutions are sort of hardwired, if you will, for for the successful, not for the struggling. I think then that it gets into a situation of just a lack of people being able to put themselves in other people's shoes. You know, I worked hard to get ahead. Why can't you? You know, and, I know full well that, you know, when I was young and I had no money and what have you, at the same time, I had some friends who helped me get a job. And you know, I don't believe there's any such thing as the self-made person, that all of us get a hand up or a little bit of a boost or good recommendation or what have you. But there is sort of this sense of, well, I worked hard, you know, you shouldn't get something for free. And there's this sense of fairness or inequality that I think kicks in. And that's because, again, the person who has had the advantage doesn't actually know what it's like to live without the advantage, you know? And so there is I don't think it's necessarily evilly intended, if that's a word. It's not a malicious thinking, like you're not worthy of help. It's that, well, you shouldn't need help. This shouldn't be necessary. Families shouldn't break up. And I think that becomes another issue of social problems. It's very easy to judge. You know, you shouldn't get addicted to drugs. You shouldn't beat your spouse. If you are beaten by your spouse, you shouldn't stay home. You know, so there's a lot of judgment, because there's a lot of belief, I think, sort of an embedded belief that somebody just needs to take action and they can solve their own problem. I don't think that's fair. Because again, a lot of individuals are trapped in their circumstances, or they don't know what they don't know to get out of their circumstances. They can't afford to get out of their circumstances. I think part of the problem, and I think you see this with people saying, you know, like, look, I never got help. My life matters. You know, that was just the way it was when I was young. All those things. I think there's an inherent fear that a lot of people have that if you somehow discount your life experience, you know, if you say, gee, I had it easier than you, or gee, I didn't stand up and fight for women's rights, you know, back in 1930, you know, or what have you. I think there's a psychological reality that takes over that somehow people feel that devalues them. Mm-hmm. I should have, you know, that for me to admit that women should not suffer, that means that I didn't stand up when I was young. I didn't have the courage. Or if I admit that, you know what, I had it easier than some people getting through school. You know, I mean, and I worked my way through school. I could tell a story of, you know, I had to go to night school and I had to pay for my own classes. At the same time, I grew up in a home of, you know, highly educated parents, and I had good vocabulary and good speaking skills and good success. And for me, all of a sudden to say, you know what, I had it easier than everybody else, I think a lot of people would feel like that somehow devalues me. Yeah. And so there's this overwhelming feeling that, well, you know, my life matters. I matter. I worked hard. I don't want to say that any of that is untrue. And I think a lot of people face this cognitive dissonance that if I say you shouldn't suffer that, then somehow that doesn't match my reality, and my story is not as valuable as your story. And I think that's where people push back, you know, because everybody wants to matter. And everybody wants to feel important. And I think it's a false trade-off. You know, just like you don't have to criticize someone for you to feel good about yourself, you don't have to tell somebody else that they have to struggle in order for you to feel good about yourself either.
Yeah. Maybe if we spent a little less time throwing up our hands at the latest presidential debate and a few more hours talking to our local candidates about the issues that matter in our own backyards, we might start seeing our opponents not as opponents, but as neighbors once again.